Activists in Europe say more than half of the food available on the continent ends up in the trash. They say it costs the economy there more than $130 billion a year. In Germany, the revelations have sparked a wave of popular movements aimed at curbing food waste. Among the most successful is a website called foodsharing.de. From Berlin, NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nilsson has the story.
One of the food-sharing internet site's founders is Cologne filmmaker Valentin Thurn. His documentary, called Taste the Waste, lays out in jolting terms how much food Europeans throw away each year, 90 million tons worth to be exact. That's enough to fill 3 million trucks stretched around the equator, according to the film. In addition, up to 50% of produce harvested at farms is thrown out, including tomatoes, the film says.
The computer checks the color to make sure they're right. And if they're the wrong color, they get zipped off to the side and thrown away.
Tuan says those statistics, as well as having parents who were hungry as children during World War II, led him on a mission with like-minded friends to try and stop so much food from being thrown away.
A lot of people ask for solutions, especially the younger ones in our team. They came up with the idea, well, everybody is talking about the sharing economy and they share everything. Why not food?
This sharing or collaborative economy, which relies heavily on the internet and makes available people's homes, cars and services, among other things, is a fast-growing trend around the globe. Filmmaker Tuan says applying that concept to thrown out food wasn't easy.
It was a little bit more tricky because food, obviously, there is a health risk associated, so we needed to establish some rules.
Tuan says after exhaustive work and consultation with lawyers, they created the nonprofit website called foodsharing.de 18 months ago. The concept is simple. Connect individuals who have food that is still good but they can no longer use with people seeking food for their personal use. Tuan says donations and grants pay for the upkeep of the website and advertisement, but the work is done by volunteers. Various supermarkets and bakers are also linked to the network, providing edible goods those businesses would otherwise throw away. These days, more than 240 German cities and 41,000 people are part of foodsharing.de. Tuan says that in the first year alone, they had 1 million visitors to the internet site. One food sharer on the site is Vero Buschmann, who lives in Berlin.
Hallo, hi, Vero. Hallo.
Hallo.
Okay, dann komm mal rein.
The child psychiatrist greets customer Franzi Zimmermann at the door and tells her to come in. The doctor shows the 26-year-old the bread she's picked up from the baker, as well as soup and chutney she's prepared, to which Zimmermann replies, wow, homemade soup, that's great, there's nothing better.
Hausgemachte Suppe.
Zimmermann, who is vegan, says she often uses the food-sharing website.
I do many things, but I'm totally broke most of the time, so this is a perfect opportunity to save money, and there's so much food wasted. Nobody's using it. That's why I try to get most of my food out of the dumpster or from food sharing.
Child psychiatrist Buschmann says she likes the idea of a shared economy, which is also why she joined Couchsurfing.org, a group that links international travelers with people willing to share their homes for free. Buschmann says she loves foodsharing.de because it does something good for society, not to mention the wide range of people she gets to meet. And the doctor says she finds the program more dignified than food banks in Germany, which require recipients to register and to line up to collect food.
I know many people who just feel ashamed to do this because everybody can see that they're queuing for this food bank thing.
Food sharing co-founder Tuan agrees, adding they alternate days with the food banks on who gets the surplus from vendors. But he says there are limits to the kind of foods his network provides. Vegetables, bread, and other items that list best before labels are allowed. Foods like meat with sell-by dates are not.
We cannot make sure that the cooling chain has been without any gap, so we don't take it at all. In this way, we avoid 99% of the risks.
He adds that people are encouraged to use the website to rate the food they get and haven't gotten any complaints. The doctor, Buschmann, says participants in foodsharing.de also assume the liability for what they give and receive.
By signing in, you sign also an application that you will not sue the shop for whatever happens to you when you eat the food. So it's just on your own responsibility. And of course, if it smells maybe weird or something, maybe better don't eat it.
The food sharing website works with volunteers called food savers, who pick up wares from supermarkets and bakers like Ali Cengiz.
And durch dieses food sharing haben wir die Möglichkeit, da noch ein bisschen was Gutes zu tun.
The baker says through this food sharing, not only do we feel we are doing something good, but we save money because it costs to haul all this stuff away as trash. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Berlin.
This is Fresh Air. More than 60 years ago, the British mathematician and computer science pioneer Alan Turing issued a famous challenge. If you could build a machine that could converse with you just as a human can, would you say it was capable of intelligent thought? A recent announcement from England claimed that a computer program had finally passed Turing's test. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks that claim is premature, but he wonders how we would react to a machine that really did appear to think and feel like us.
To judge from some of the headlines, it was a very big deal. At an event held by the Royal Society in London, for the first time ever, a computer passed the Turing test, which is widely taken as the benchmark for saying a machine is engaging in intelligent thought. But like the other much-hyped triumphs of artificial intelligence, this one wasn't quite what it appeared. Computers can do things that seem quintessentially human, but they usually take a different path to get there. IBM's Deep Blue mastered chess not by refining its intuitions, but by evaluating hundreds of millions of positions per second. Watson won at Jeopardy not by wide reading, but by swallowing all of Wikipedia in a single gulp. And as the software that reportedly beat the Turing test showed, computers don't even go about making small talk the same way we do. The Turing test takes its name from a 1950 paper by Alan Turing, the British mathematician who laid out the foundations of modern computer science. Turing had wearied of the interminable debates about whether machines could really think. The question we should be asking, he said, is whether they can behave the same way a thinking person does. Put a human and computer in another room and hold a conversation with each of them via a teletype. If you can't tell which is which, then you might as well say the computer's thinking. Turing's claim has inspired more than half a century of ardent philosophical noodling about mind and consciousness. But Turing also regarded the test as a practical challenge. By the end of the 20th century, he said, computers will be so good at ordinary conversation that they'll fool people into taking them for humans at least 30% of the time. And ever since, people have been building programs called chatterbots designed to do just that, with modest success. In the recent Royal Society competition, a bot called Eugene Goostman managed to convince a third of the judges it was a human on the basis of a 5-minute exchange. That narrowly exceeded Turing's more or less arbitrary 30% threshold, and the organizers proclaimed it a historic milestone. But given the still rudimentary state of AI, a lot of people in the field dismiss these competitions as mere stunts. The fact is that nobody would claim that these bots are doing anything remotely like thinking. They rely on clever but fairly simple routines and on the human predilection to personify our interactions with machines. When the bots don't understand a question, they throw it back as another question or key in on one phrase and return a canned response. Ask Eugene Goostman how many legs a camel has, and it will say no more than 4, which is the same answer it gives if you ask it how many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man. And Goostman's creators ratcheted down the judge's expectations still further by having the bot claim to be a 13-year-old boy from Ukraine. That seemed to account for its faulty English and limited world knowledge, not to mention some of its off-the-wall answers. What sounds merely witless in grown-ups is apt to come off in a 13-year-old as simple attitude. But the exercise did drive home a point that psychologists have been aware of for a long time. What makes a computer seem human isn't how we perceive its intellect, but its affect. Can it display frustration, surprise, or delight just as we would? A computer scientist friend of mine makes that point by proposing his own version of the Turing test. He says, say I'm writing a program and type in a couple of lines of clever code. I want the machine to say, ooh, neat. That's the goal of the hot new field called affective computing. aimed at getting machines to detect and express emotions. Wouldn't it be nice if the airline's automated agent could rejoice with you when you get an upgrade? Or at least if it could sound that way. Designers of speech synthesizers are on the case. Here's an IBM speech system repeating the same sentence, first with no affect, and then in an upbeat voice.
These cookies are delicious. These cookies are delicious.
That's not half bad. It almost crosses the line to creepy. But of course, it's one thing to be able to express emotions and another to really feel them. A lot of people maintain that that's something computers simply can't do. As a contemporary of Turing put it, no mechanism could feel grief when its valves fuse or be made miserable by its mistakes. That sounds right to me. How could a machine feel any of those emotions without a human body to touch them off? You can get it to signal sorrow by synthesizing a catch in its voice, but it's not going to be caused by a real sob rising in its chest. But I'll keep an open mind. Turing saw the achievement of human-like intelligence as lying 50 years out, and AI people say exactly the same thing now. Who knows, they may catch up with the horizon one day and produce a contrivance that's bristling with all the traits we think of as uniquely human, creativity, passion, even gender. That's the being that Spike Jonze envisions in his movie Her, set in the near future. The title refers to an intelligent operating system voiced by Scarlett Johansson, with which, or should I say with whom, Joaquin Phoenix's character Theodore falls in love. It's fair to say there's never been a computer in or out of the movies that was better equipped to ace the Turing test than Johansson's sultry, high-spirited Samantha. She sulks and sighs just like a woman, but when she and Theodore have a lover's spat near the end of the movie, he accuses her of acting more human than she actually is.
What's going on with us?
I don't know. It's probably just me.
What is it?
Just signing the divorce papers.
Is there anything else, though?
No, just that.
Okay.
Why do you do that?
What?
Nothing, it's just, you go, as you're speaking, and it seems odd. Oh. You just did it again.
Did I? Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know, it's just maybe an affectation. I probably picked it up from you.
God, it's not like you need oxygen or anything, it's just...
I guess that's just... I was trying to communicate, that's how people talk, so that's how people communicate, and I thought...
Because they're people, they need oxygen, you're not a person.
What is your problem?
Frankly, I wouldn't have been that hard on Samantha here, and neither would Turing. He replied to those claims that machines couldn't be conscious or have real feelings with a simple question. How can you tell? After all, how can we know for sure that anybody else is really conscious except by taking it on faith? As Turing said, we just accept that everybody who seems to be thinking and feeling really is. He described that as a polite convention. But I think most people now would say that it's hardwired into our own OS. We're just built to connect. True, Theodore and Samantha could never really get each other. Neither can know what the other actually feels. But so what? We were taking each other's feelings on faith long before anybody turned sand into silicon. As the poet Randall Jarrell might have put it, computers and humans are like men and women. Each understands the other worse, and it matters less than either of them suppose.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
right. So let's talk about solving psychological problems in this next story. Traditionally, of course, talking to a therapist has required going to an office and talking face to face. But as NPR's Manvi Singh reports, the internet is changing that. More people, especially younger people, are going online for their mental health services.
Lauren Key has never met her therapist in person. She's a 24-year-old entrepreneur who lives in New York.
It can be really hard to have to take off from work and commute, especially like in New York, 2 hours round trip to see a therapist.
She finds that it's much more convenient to see her therapist online.
It's been the best relationship that I've had with a therapist.
She found the counselor on a website called prettypaddedroom.com. She chose her out of a list of licensed therapists and social workers. When it's time for her appointment, she logs in, clicks on a link, and begins her video session.
You know, it felt like Skyping with a friend. And when I was at my parents' house the other day, you know, I got to show my therapist my cat. So, it just makes it more personal where you can sort of bring your therapist into your home and really talk about what's going on.
She's not alone in that thinking. More and more people, especially millennials, people born in the 1980s and 1990s, are trying this out.
What's happened is that we've gotten really used to using on-demand services to make our lives easier. You know, everything from booking a taxi to food to booking a date.
The founder of the online therapy service, Pretty Padded Room, is Bea Arthur. She says there's a real demand for web therapy right now.
For the most part, our target market is women in their 20s and 30s.
She says it works really well for young people on the go.
You know, job issues, breakups, adult friendships breaking up. Just there's so many transitions that occur during this time. And we've really gone out of our way to kind of curate an experience that speaks to them.
A 30-minute session is $45 or less if you sign up for a monthly plan. There are 9 therapists to choose from based all over the country. And patients from all over the world can use the service.
We have clients in Belgium and Saudi Arabia and Korea. I mean, it's been amazing.
Pretty Padded Room isn't unique. A bunch of other companies have the same idea. There's a website called Breakthrough, another called Virtual Therapy Connect. The list goes on and on. Studies suggest that therapy online can be just as effective as in person. Lynn Bufka is with the American Psychological Association.
I think we have a lot of promising data suggesting that technology can be a very good means of providing treatment. I don't think we have all the answers yet.
There are cases where therapy online may not work. Online therapists usually don't treat people with severe issues, especially those who may be contemplating suicide. Privacy is another concern. To protect confidentiality, some of these companies use special teleconferencing software with extra security. And then there's the issue of licensing. Therapists are licensed to practice by individual state boards. Bufka wants to see a special certification for therapists who live in one state and want to treat people who live elsewhere.
We'd like to see a little more mobility and flexibility with that because certainly for licensed psychologists, the standards are pretty similar across state lines.
Sorting these issues out is crucial because as the world continues to move online, people are increasingly looking for mental health care on the internet.
This is going to be the new way.
That's John Kim. He's the founder of The Angry Therapist, another online service. As communication technology gets better, Kim thinks online therapy will continue to grow.
Before, you know, when the internet was on dial-up and stuff, it was really hard to do something like this. But now, I mean, you could literally see a teardrop. You could, you know, Skyping with someone is just as effective, sometimes if not more, than in person. When you open up your laptop or on your desktop, you just see your therapist and it's a lot more casual. It takes away the stigma of therapy.
Kim sees clients both online and in person. And he says some of his clients actually feel more comfortable chatting on Skype than they do talking face-to-face. Manvi Singh, NPR News.
The Supreme Court gave broadcasters a huge win this week in their battle against a service called Aereo. Subscribers in 11 cities have been using it to watch and record broadcast TV. With Aereo now deemed illegal, NPR's Elise Hugh explores what's next for consumers.
In her final year as a law student at NYU, Amanda Lewandowski learned the nitty-gritty of copyright law. She says it's worth it because that's how she first heard about Aereo.
I really wanted to be able to stream
local channels so I could watch TV shows sooner than the sort of 1 week delay that you get on Hulu and without doing an additional long-term paid subscription with a deluxe service.
Like cable. The 2-year-old Aereo lets her do exactly what she wants. It picks up live TV signals and sends them to internet-connected devices like phones, tablets, desktop computers. So Lewandowski became a subscriber this January.
I'm watching the World Cup in one tab. And on my recordings, I'm able to watch the episode of The Good Wife.
The service costs users anywhere between $8 and $12 a month.
I can watch it at home. I can watch it from campus. And you can record a significant amount of television shows to watch later.
Those TV shows Lewandowski has saved to watch later is exactly what she's worried about now. It's unclear how long she and other Aereo subscribers will still get the service. Aereo was showing network TV content without paying the same licensing fees cable and satellite companies do. That led to a legal battle that wound up at the Supreme Court. In March, I asked Aereo's CEO, Chet Kanoja, what would happen if he lost.
Do you have a contingency plan in case it doesn't go your way?
No.
Wednesday, the Supreme Court ruled Aereo's service is running afoul of copyright laws.
It's got to unwind pretty fast.
That's Forrester analyst Jim Nail. He says it won't make sense for the company to start paying rebroadcast fees because that would end its price advantage over cable. But he does credit Aereo for giving cable some competition, even if it lost in court.
What this does give these incumbent, you know, cable companies and broadcast companies, I think it gives them a little bit of a window to continue improving and rolling out their own TV Everywhere services. And if they get that right, then there's much less incentive for consumers to pay attention to those new innovators.
Aereo says it's still evaluating its options. The company holds more than a dozen patents, so its technology could live on in reworked ways. But analysts aren't optimistic.
It's just flat out illegal. So how long can a company continue an illegal activity?
For subscribers like Lewandowski, the binge watching begins. She's got to catch up with hours of recorded TV, especially her favorite, The Good Wife, on CBS.
We've always had bad timing, haven't we?
We have.
I might binge through these final episodes of The Good Wife to get up to real time. I just know that that's going to be sort of an emotional move.
What she's really sad about is what happens in the fall when new television seasons begin. By then, Aereo will likely be over. Elise Hu, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court ruled this week that, with the exception of some emergencies, the police cannot search a cell phone without a warrant during an arrest. To put a literary spin on this news, we turn to poet Craig Morgan Teicher. Here he is for our series, This Week's Must Read.
Privacy fans cheered. The police weren't so psyched. But the justices ruled unanimously. Our devices, with our texts, our photos, our scribbles, stay private. We can hide in plain sight. This isn't a new idea. The confessional poets have been doing it for decades. Instead of keeping their secrets, they turn them into performance. My favorite of these is a book-length poem by A.R. Ammons. It's called Tape for the Turn of the Year. He wrote it on a roll of adding machine paper, kind of like Jack Kerouac's famous On the Road scroll, only skinnier. At the time, he was full of anxiety and anticipation. I'm waiting to hear if Cornell will give me a job, he writes. I need to work, and maybe I write too much. He also mixes in what he sees out his window. The touched, tasted, heard, seen, he says. Plus all sorts of silly musings. Swing your partner. Promenade, he tells us. And he describes the tape he writes on, how it coils again on the floor into the unity of its conflicts. Ammons shows us his actual mind. It's crabby, overexcited, scared, and endlessly curious. This book doesn't contain evidence of illicit drug deals or gang memberships like the most scintillating smartphones, but it's more than most of us would show a stranger. It offers up what we always hide, the fabric of our innermost thoughts. That's something no warrant can uncover, nor any ruling protect.
The book is Tape for the Turn of the Year by A.R. Ammons. It was recommended by Craig Morgan Teicher. His latest book is called To Keep Love Blurry.
We've reported on protests in San Francisco against Google using private buses to shuttle its workers to and from work. And now there's another transit fight brewing, this one over parking. A few tech entrepreneurs are selling public parking spots in San Francisco, even auctioning them off to the highest bidder. The city's attorney says it's illegal. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
Cruise around the Mission District in San Francisco and between the Pentecostal churches and the trendy new restaurants and people moving in and out, it can be really hard to find a parking spot.
I've spent as much as 45 minutes to an hour looking for spots, depending on the night of the week.
Especially with all the construction going on, because usually during the day, the construction workers take all of the day spots.
This is not a parking spot, actually. We're parked in front of a garage.
Drivers Robert Aparicio, Carol Scanlon, and Sean Carroll have familiar problems. And now a handful of technology startups have come up with a novel solution. Mobile apps that let people with public metered parking spots sell to those without.
The highest price that has ever been paid is $15.
Paolo Dobrowolny is CEO of Monkey Parking, and he says drivers can make up to $150 a month with his app.
So I have the right to tell when I am about to leave from a parking spot, and I have the right to be paid for giving this information to someone who wants it.
Parking apps are the newest offering in the sharing economy. But unlike services that connect homeowners and car owners to online customers, these apps are built on a public resource. And before they get too popular, the city of San Francisco wants to shut them down. Matt Dorsey is spokesman for the San Francisco City Attorney's Office.
San Francisco's police code already prohibits anybody from buying or selling or renting on-street parking. There's really no gray area here. It was illegal before the internet, and it's illegal after the internet.
The city recently served a cease and desist letter to Monkey Parking. Drivers using the app could be fined $300 per parking violation under a 1980 statute. Dorsey says this app and similar ones are a public safety hazard, encouraging people to stare at their phone while driving. And they're plain unfair. Say I'm a blue-collar worker late for a date.
And there's a highly desirable parking spot, but somebody is holding it hostage while, you know, somebody with a lot of wealth can outbid me for it. That's not what on-street public parking is supposed to be about.
So the idea that things are built on top of government infrastructure or are taking advantage of public resources for profit isn't anything new.
Arun Sundararajan is an economist at New York University who points out that telephone carriers and private garages build their businesses on top of public resources.
A lot of the capitalist economy is built on government infrastructure.
Price is a separate issue. In much of the sharing economy, services drive down the price. Airbnb is cheaper than Hilton. Zipcar for an hour is cheaper than Hertz for a day. But Sundararajan says sharing can just as easily lead to scalping or bidding wars.
I don't think that we should be surprised if the sharing economy marketplaces do in fact lead to higher prices for certain things.
Monkey Parking says it will not shut down despite the city's order because it's not selling parking. The app is helping people share information about spots and decide what that information is worth. Arthi Shahani, NPR News, San Francisco.